This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The United States is prohibiting and preventing people in many ways from traveling to Cuba or making it extremely difficult.
We hear from former Congresswoman Barbara Lee about her Cuba activism, as well as sanctuary policies and police accountability in Oakland, California.
What we're pushing for is that there be no cooperation by any Tulare agency with INS and ICE. So we are pushing for sanctuary, and I think that that's what people around the country need to be doing.
The terrorism of the growing immigration raids has already affected farm worker communities in California's Central Valley.
For one, it's ensuring that people within these agencies do not step into school sites, period. And I know that's an imminent threat.
Gabriela Lopez, former San Francisco Board of Education president, speaks about the measures educators are taking to protect immigrant students.
We went to the Chase Center to raise awareness about Rwanda's ongoing occupation of the Congo. We were calling on the NBA to cut all ties with Rwanda.
Congo activists protest the National Basketball Association's alliance with Rwandan President Paul Kagame at the NBA All-Star Game. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Block Report's J.R. Valray speaks with former Congresswoman Barbara Lee on her fight to end the U.S. blockade on Cuba, her role in Biden's brief removal of Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism list, and Trump's reversal. As Barbara Lee runs for mayor of Oakland, California, she also discusses policing contradictions, ICE crackdowns, and Oakland's housing crisis.
Can you talk about your work in getting Biden to sign legislation taking Cuba off of the list of state sponsors of terrorism and its significance in light of the 63-year blockade against Cuba?
You know, it took 4 years, first of all. Let me just give you a bit of history. For those who don't know, there's been an embargo against Cuba since the late 50s, and in fact, it has not worked. And I have, since 1977, tried to normalize relations with this country, Afro-Hispanic country, 90 miles from the coast of Florida. And there have been presidents who have supported trying to lift the embargo or develop normal relations, and some who have been very adamant about not lifting the embargo and keeping Cuba isolated, basically from the United States, because most of the world engages with Cuba. And I'm just talking about normal diplomatic trade, people-to-people relations like we do with Vietnam and China and France and every other country in the world. So having said that, when President Obama was in, I've worked to help begin to open Cuba up in terms of U.S.-Cuba relations. I led the effort to open up an embassy there. Initially, it had been an interest section only. And I went with President Obama when he went down to recognize the beginning of normal relations with Cuba. And that opened up dialogue. It opened up a way for the United States and Cuba to engage on the tough issues, quite frankly, on human rights, on trade, on immigration, on environmental issues. You know, how you engage in a bilateral way with most countries in the world, whether you agree or disagree with their forms of government, you still have to engage if we're going to truly achieve global peace and security for people throughout the world. And so this was moving in the correct direction until Donald Trump comes in. And what he does is begin to turn around and turn back the clock 50 years. And then toward the end of his first term, probably about 2 weeks, maybe not even 2 weeks before his first term ended, he put Cuba on the state sponsor of terrorism list. Even the Defense Department acknowledged they're not a terrorist nation. They've never engaged in terrorism, and they should not belong on that list. And every other country in the world knows that also. And this has really hampered not only the U.S. and Cuba in terms of developing normal relations and moving forward, it has really hurt the Cuban people tremendously. You see migration from Cuba increasing. The economic situation is dire. But the Cuban people have a lot of strength and resilience, and they're making a way, as we say in the Black church, out of no way. So when President Biden was sworn in, myself and a couple of senators and a couple of members of Congress insisted we have a meeting with President Obama, which we did in the White House. I was sitting next to him and talking to him, and we went around the table. Everyone said what they had to say. All of us were on the same page about why we needed to get Cuba off the state sponsor of terrorism. And for 4 years, I've been working on this, sending letters, having meetings, going to Cuba, trying to, which I did help negotiate a resolve to some of the highly confidential and highly international national security issues. You know, as one who was on the Appropriations Committee, I was the chair and then ranking member of the State and Foreign Operations Committee. And so I had access to quite a bit of the intelligence and what both sides were saying. And so I helped move the ball forward. Finally, we were able to remove Cuba from the state sponsor of terrorism list probably a week or two before President Biden left office, which I thought, you know, we were all happy about that. It should have happened a week after he was sworn in, though. There was no reason to leave Cuba on this list. And then here comes President Trump, and he puts them back on the state sponsor of terrorism. So it's a terrible signal that this country is sending to the rest of the world, and how they're just really trying to squeeze the Cuban people, trying to keep Americans from traveling to Cuba. I mean, the right to travel, everyone should have to travel to wherever they want to travel. And the United States is prohibiting and preventing people in many ways from traveling to Cuba, or making it extremely difficult. Farmers, pharmaceutical companies, exchanges, the people-to-people kind of work that we had begun under President Obama has, for the most part, been halted. And so I hope people listening to this understand that they need to stay engaged, and there are ways to still go to Cuba. I was down for one day in December. Southwest Airlines has direct flights out of, I believe, Tampa and Havana. American and United, both, as of December, flights were still going in and out. But I hope people don't allow this man in the White House to deter them from the struggle and the movement and the correct strategy to keep the pressure on members of Congress to not allow Donald Trump to do even more harm to Cuba, and to keep working to lift the embargo, because this is a failed policy. U.S. tax dollars are contributing to this failed policy, and also to the desperation and suffering of the Cuban people.
To just connect your career as a retired congresswoman and your upcoming bid for mayor of Oakland, Oakland is a sanctuary city. Right now, Trump has unleashed ICE nationally and has opened up Cuba's Guantanamo Bay prison for deportees. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are thoughts that I hope people who voted for Donald Trump understand what is taking place. This is a democracy, and people have a right to vote for whomever they want to vote for. And I hope that they understand that this is causing tremendous harm to people. And in fact, coming from Oakland and running for mayor, and also having supported sanctuary cities and sanctuary states around the country, it's despicable, it's wrong. And we're going to have to make sure that we unify as a community and not allow Donald Trump to divide the community, because he is masterful at dividing black and brown people and white people and people he considers the other from each other. And we're going to have to make sure we protect our immigrants. And of course, you know, he's talking about deporting criminals. Well, criminals should be arrested and, you know, anyway. And so the deportation efforts through ICE is something that I don't support, I oppose. And if the good people of Oakland elect me as mayor, I will do everything I can do, supporting lawsuits, supporting the community to protect our immigrants, protect our children, provide strategies for trauma-informed care, and making sure that the young people especially feel safe in going to school, that people feel safe in going to church or however they worship, and people don't worry about ICE picking them up because they know that we have a sanctuary city where everyone is going to make sure that Donald Trump does not accomplish his goals, and that of deporting people who are here in our community who deserve to be able to stay here.
In light of the pro-police backlash against George Floyd policies, do you feel like it is a contradiction for black politicians to be pro-police when talking about public safety in black neighborhoods, but be anti-ICE when talking about immigrants in brown neighborhoods?
No, in terms of, look, we want justice and equality under the law. And every community wants public safety. We want our children safe and our community safe. And we want police accountability. And we want to make sure that the police understand the community and do not act inappropriately. And that's what this whole struggle for police accountability has been and continues to be about. No one is above the law. And so there's no contradiction. I mean, we've got to push back with ICE because ICE is, we're a sanctuary city and we have certain requirements under sanctuary city to not allow ICE to come in. They're not here to protect the community. Public safety is public safety, and that's about preventing crimes, making sure there are alternatives to especially first-time offenders, the young people who commit these crimes that need to be put on the right track, if we could, you know, in terms of supporting alternatives. But people who, gun violence is something we need to address, and there's a public safety strategy that, at least here in Oakland, the voters voted for, which is comprehensive, which involves preventing crimes from happening using ceasefire and macro and mental health workers and other non-policing to help people before crimes are committed. So we have to have and believe in a comprehensive public safety strategy, even those who are fighting for only police accountability, which we must have. And I'm one of those who want to see they need to be respectful of black communities and brown communities and low-income communities and treat everyone equal as it relates to police accountability. And that's what this is about. Oh, go on. I'm sorry.
Well, can I ask you, I mean, you're saying this and it sounds very good for people that live outside of Oakland, but Oakland's police department has been under federal receivership for 20 years, over 20 years. So they haven't been following the law, even according to the Department of Justice. Then you look at the fact that Trump has also just halted cases on civil rights violations for police departments. It's starting to not look safe in the black neighborhood. So I'm starting to look at this as a major contradiction. Because there is no DOJ looking over corrupt police departments, and Oakland is one of the most corrupt police departments in the country. So how do you say that argument with
knowing
that?
That's why they're still under a federal monitor. And the Department of Justice, a Trump Department of Justice, is a Department of Justice that is not upholding any type of equal justice under the law or police accountability. And so we have to make sure that the Police Review Commission does their job, and we have to make sure that people locally hold police accountable, because we know the Department of Justice is not going to do it at all. But at least still the monitor is, until the work is complete, Oakland will stay under a federal monitor, and we need to make sure that the work is completed, because that's the only way I think the public can believe that the police department is earning or trying to earn their trust.
Trump is talking about giving police immunity. It doesn't seem like we're having the same conversation. Have you heard Trump talk about giving police immunity under his administration? If that's the case, how could progressive politicians work with police departments and talk about public safety?
That's Donald Trump. People voted for Donald Trump, so this is what they got, okay? And all I'm saying is we have to get politically active, first of all, and not just leave it up to others, but we have to locally. I don't think that Donald Trump, until the pressure gets there from his voters to stop what he is doing, that he's going to stop it. He's acting as if he's above the law. And so far, he has acted with impunity. The courts are holding him up on some of his actions, But we're going to have to file more lawsuits against the Trump administration. And in the meantime, find ways to hold local police accountable for their work, but also for public safety, because every community wants to be safe and deserves to be safe.
Oakland's homeless population has exploded over the last half of a decade. How will you be able to put in practical measures that will at least stop the flow of people becoming homeless and provide more for affordable housing under your administration if you were to become mayor of Oakland?
And a large percentage of unsheltered people are Black, and so there's an equity issue also that we have to deal with. A couple of things. It's first a moral disgrace and stain on any community that so many people are unsheltered. So we have to make sure we have tenant protections in place that are very strong and make sure that eviction protections are in place. Secondly, the cost of living, we know, and the cost of housing in California and Oakland is very high. And we have people who can't afford to live here and can't afford to rent or buy property. So thirdly, if people end up on the streets, I think the first thing I would want to do differently is make sure that we have enough transitional housing and permanent housing and mental health services and wraparound services so we can quickly offer and get them to, you know, off of the streets as quickly as possible, because the longer people stay unsheltered, that becomes home and it becomes even more difficult for them to leave home. So the expeditious nature of helping people find a place to live is extremely important. Next, I think, and I've looked at Portland and some other communities, which I would like to see if we could pilot here in Oakland, and that's by trying to hire unsheltered people, you know, provide a paycheck, universal basic income, because people deserve their dignity and deserve to work, and help provide for that, to help go into cleaning up blight, for example, into some job training initiatives. A couple of people are doing that right now here in Oakland. And also in Portland, Oregon, just as an example, they've reduced the unsheltered population by 70%. And people have found permanent housing and they have acquired job skills and they now have jobs. So different and new ways to approach this really terrible moral, you know, events in Oakland and other cities have to be addressed in a comprehensive way, and we can't piecemeal it. And Oakland has a budget deficit, and so we have to look at how we can better use our resources. And I believe that our Department of Housing and our homeless providers are doing a phenomenal job with little resources. So I would want to see if I could find and identify outside resources to bring in to really help do some new kinds of strategies to help our homeless and unsheltered population get the services that they need, prevent evictions, make sure that they can get a job and job training. And we have to do it, I believe, in a different way.
Ms. Lee, thank you for your time.
So
and I appreciate your upfrontness and you facing the hard questions.
No. I hope I've earned the vote of voters in Oakland, and hard questions during campaigns and during serving as a public servant have come to me for quite a few years. So I really thank you for giving me a chance to be with you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was former Congresswoman Barbara Lee speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. That was Bob Marley and the Wailers, Johnny Was. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasiliev. The terrorism of the growing immigration raids has already affected farm workers and the farm worker community near Visalia, California. Mary Jane Galviso grew up in a Philippine-American farm worker's family and now works in a co-op farm set up by Filipino farm workers. She spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
I'm Mary Jane Galviso. I'm the director of the Rural Communities Resource Center, and we're located on Ilocano Farms here in Rosie, which is in Tulare County in the California Central Valley. Just a little bit of background. Fresno, Tulare, and Kern County are the three top county producers for the United States. They generate the most in vegetables, fruits, and nuts for the nation and for export. Another interesting thing about these three counties is that agribusiness today for the past 5 years has been posting historic levels of profits, billions in profits. And recently in May, UC Merced, and we should all look at that report, did a study to show that nearly half of the agricultural workers producing these billions of profits are undocumented, have no papers. And these are the people who are most affected, of course, by Trump's sweeping immigration acts. So today, this morning, we did receive the report. It's part of that leaked memo that's stating that there will be an INS sweep in our county seat, which is Visalia. And so we're advising people who don't have your papers to stay home and don't open that door and basically to know your rights. So I have a couple of people here that would like to share some of their experience. ¿Quieres hablar ahora?
Yeah, of course.
Andres Mendez.
Hi, sir.
So maybe you can talk about what you think about this effort by the Trump government to deport mass deportations. What does that mean to you? Personally
means like they used to do the same thing before, and nowadays they're doing the same thing. So I feel worried about it, because they just pull you over, whoever, you just look Hispanic, and they right away they take you out. Like, you know, they don't care. People don't care about us. So that's why I feel like afraid.
And how has it affected your family and your community?
Yeah, and the community, of course, the community is, everyone's talking about it. No one wants to go out. Nobody wants to go to the stores, nothing like that. Not to work, neither. So yeah, and the family, my family, we all worry about it. My family, my cousins, everyone.
And you're doing a lot of the work to produce for the people of the United States and the people of this world. What do you think about what the purpose of this is from the government and Trump administration and the Democrats as well, who deported people too?
Yeah, well, like I said, we're in a big trouble because of that massive deportations. And I wish we could have a real president that he could care about us, but he doesn't. So I wish we could have a better life, a better person, you know, a president. That's what I'm talking about. I think there's another lady that I'm talking to.
Maybe you can talk about your life and how you're being affected by these raids and the government and Trump government trying to attack you and other farm workers in Central Valley.
Pues asustados, espantados todos, asustados por todo lo que está pasando, por simplemente por las deportaciones, por los hijos.
We're all worried about the deportations, about our children, the situation here.
And what will happen to your children? Were they born in the United States?
Pues son nacidos aquí, pero pues el miedo es si deportan a uno a nosotros.
My children were born here in this country, but what will happen to them if me and my husband get deported?
Pero tengo dos grandes que no son de aquí, no son nacidos aquí.
And I also have two older children that were not born here, and they're the ones who are working in the fields.
How is this affecting your family? Are you afraid to go out? And also, if you get sick, are you worried about going to a hospital? Because the government is saying that they're going to try to get people to say that they're whether or not they're legal in order to go to a hospital.
Pues sí, cuando uno se enferma, a mí sí me da miedo ir al hospital por todo lo que está pasando.
Yeah, she's saying that she is worried about to go to the hospital whenever she gets sick, because she could get deported or something like that. She's just afraid.
I was asking about the school. What's the situation? Yeah. How is the school helping the community? ¿La escuela se está ayudando a la comunidad?
Sí, la escuela, sí. A mí me da miedo ir a las tiendas. So, ahorita salir, no salgo mucho a las tiendas porque me da miedo.
Right now, I'm not going to the stores very much because I'm very afraid.
What can people in this country do to support you? Because there are many people in the United States who are against this deportations, the mass deportations. What can people do? What do you think they should do to support your struggle for human rights, for worker rights?
You cambie el presidente.
Change the president.
Change the president. What kind of work have you done? What kind of farm work have you been working? What crops have you worked? What's your experience as an agriculture farm worker?
Naranja.
Yeah, she picks oranges and she does labor work in the fields.
And these companies make a lot of money off of your labor. Have you received good wages?
El mínimo, ¿no?
Yeah. She's saying that she gets the minimum wage.
What's happening in the schools in your area? Are children afraid to go to school?
Oh, mis niños no quieren ir a la escuela. Me dicen que porque si en la escuela van y les preguntan dónde viven sus papás, ellos tienen miedo que sepan dónde vivimos nosotros y dicen, mami, si te echan a ti para México, ¿con quién nos quedamos nosotros?
Yeah, and they're worried about their parents because if immigration deport them, they're thinking how they're going to survive, you know what I mean? How they're going to do to survive their mom, their dad, they're going to be deported. So that's why they don't want to go. They don't even want to go to school anymore because of the massive deportations.
Do you think that farm workers and other people should organize to protect themselves against these assaults?
Well, let me speak to that. First of all, I think on a broad level, many of the progressive organizations here, we've been coming together and calling for Tulare County, the Board of Supervisors, the city councils to declare sanctuary. As you know, Tulare County has always pushed back. It's a very right county. And while there are certain who say that they will not cooperate, we know that 2 weeks ago in Dinuba, the Dinuba Police Department were stopping people and asking for ID. So there is a level of cooperation with ICE and with INS here. And what we're pushing for, of course, is that there be no cooperation by any Tulare agency with INS and ICE. So we are pushing for sanctuary. And I think that that's what people around the country need to be doing to protect, to create safe spaces for workers, for agricultural workers in this country. That's one of the most important things.
Corporate farm owners in Central Valley, isn't it true that many of them supported Trump and supported these policies?
Very foolishly they did, just like the Midwest farmers. And I think they're getting a taste of that poison. You see them on media now saying that they need the workers. We're coming into the spring. You know, it's the planting season. It's you know, you've got to get your crops in now for your summer harvest. So if they don't have the workers, they know that they're going to be in a very, very difficult position. So you do see them on social media. And I'm sure their lobbyists are working hard and frantically trying to get some exemptions. But as I mentioned, it's interesting. INS has been basically in the cities, Visalia, Dinuba, and haven't quite reached into the rural areas yet in the fields. No, we don't see them here yet, but that doesn't mean that they're not going to be. But they're going to go after the, you know, the easy picking, you know, just do traffic stops and grab people.
And the history of organizing, farm worker organizing, Al Rojas, who was one of the co-founders of the United Farm Workers, Farm Workers Organizing Committee, how did they organize the immigrant workers and fight back against the efforts of the government to terrorize these workers so they wouldn't join unions?
We're here.
We don't have a plan. We don't have a plan yet, but we must do a plan so we could gather all together and think how we can do so we can avoid the raids and everything. You know what I mean?
At this time, there's no presence of the UFW in our rural communities. You don't see them here. They do no organizing, no unionizing here. So I would say that let's just say 99.9% of all agricultural workers here are not in the union, are not unionized, don't have collective bargaining rights. And they're basically, it's up to them to fend for themselves at this point. So it's going to fall, I believe, on progressive organizations to really push for sanctuary, to push back against Trump's.
The ICE and the immigration, how have they been used to prevent organizing? Do they try to intimidate people so they don't join unions? How is the history of that in the Central Valley in California? And how did unions fight back against that?
Well, there's always been that history. As you know, there were always sweeping deportations anytime there were unionizing, you know, efforts. In fact, they were called in to take people, to take workers. So it goes hand in hand, and that's the greatest fear factor. And when you don't have a union and you don't have an organizing effort, you're much more vulnerable. And that's the situation here in the Central Valley now. That's
and
why.
What was the role of Biden and Obama and the Democratic Party? Because they say that the problem is immigration, the problem is the borders, and they have supported more police and ICE on the border. What do you think about that whole policy of the Democratic Party?
I think to understand that policy, you do have to understand what's happening in the United States. Okay, because immigration law fundamentally, in essence, is about the control of labor, bringing in workers, excluding workers, or throwing out workers when you don't want them anymore. And we are in a very monumental transition in the U.S. agricultural sector. Last year, Wawona, the largest packing operation here, closed down. There's more and more agribusiness that is jumping the border. Why? In the Central Valley, our water table is basically depleted, right? They've got to go where the green is, where the grass is greener, and the grass is greener in Mexico and in Central America. So you're seeing this big transition, just like there was a Rust Belt in the East Coast, right? Yeah, the industrial base was dismantled and moved out of the U.S. Well, now that's happening here. The agricultural base is now being dismantled and is moving out of the U.S. And I think that explains part of why the attack on immigrant workers, especially in the rural areas, is happening. You know, Driscoll berries, most of the berries, you'll go to your supermarket and look at the labels on the fruits and vegetables that you're eating now. Most of them are coming from Mexico and Central America, especially in the winter months. So this is just simply going to accelerate. And that's one reason why they're pushing out agricultural workers from here.
That was Mary Jane Galviso and farm workers near Visalia, California, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Hasta México ha llegado la noticia muy alegre que de verlo es diferente. Pues el pueblo ya está en contra de los rancheros y engreídos que acababan con la gente. Y como somos hermanos, la alegría compartimos con todos los campesinos. ¡Viva la revolución! ¡Viva nuestra asociación! ¡Viva huelga en general! El 18 de septiembre de los campos de Deleno salieron los filipinos. después de 2 semanas para unirse a la batalla salieron los mexicanos. Y juntos vamos cumpliendo con la marcha de la historia para liberar el pueblo. ¡Viva la revolución! ¡Viva nuestra asociación! ¡Viva huelga general! ¡Viva la huelga en el fin! ¡Viva la causa y la historia! ¡La raza llena de gloria! ¡La victoria va a cumplir!
That was Los Lobos performing Huelga en General, General Strike, United Farm Workers song. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Gabriela Lopez is the former San Francisco Board of Education president, who was recalled with 2 other members of the board in 2022 after fighting to integrate San Francisco's prestigious Lowell High School. Speaking to J.R. Valray, Lopez discusses the measures San Francisco teachers are taking to protect immigrant students. She also weighs in on the Trump administration's war on the U.S. Board of Education.
San Francisco is a sanctuary city. How are immigrant students feeling after Trump has unleashed ICE on the country right after he was sworn into office?
The one thing that we could count on is people organizing even before he came into office, just given the threats that he was making before the beginning of this year. And my connection is directly with teachers, so I know a lot of them are already making sure that people in the community, specifically families, know their rights. They're aware of what they need to be doing when and if confronted with ICE. Like, they're really stepping up and taking care of students. They're making sure that no one's coming into our buildings. I think San Francisco is really key about that and always has been. And then, you know, the campaign to get the red cards out and into the hands of the people who really will benefit from learning about this right is happening nonstop. So I know we can rely on teachers really protecting our students during this time.
You spoke a little bit about it in the last answer, but how exactly are teachers organizing among themselves? What kind of things are they doing to protect the students specifically? And can you share some of the rights that immigrants have that they may not know?
For one, it's ensuring that people within these agencies do not step into school sites, period. And I know that's an imminent threat, but given our sanctuary city status, that is the clear protector to make sure that there's no ICE agents or any idea of that happening in our schools, inside our school buildings. So there's a lot of clarity around that and ensuring families that's what school sites are able and will be doing, protecting students no matter what. There are a lot of workshops going on. And because some of our families are truly fearing even leaving their homes, that they've been hosting online to just kind of have that availability and added protection to let them know about, like, how to deal with anyone if they are confronted by an ICE agent, or what to say, what not to say, and how they have the right to do that. They have the right to remain silent. They have the right to protect themselves. That kind of thing of just, like, ensuring that any intimidation is against their constitutional rights, and teaching families that they can enforce that and knowing that they're protected in that way.
What are your thoughts on Trump and Elon Musk's recent raid on the Department of Education?
You know, it's interesting because the entire process has been very troubling given the hypocrisy. And this is something that I've been battling with in having conversations with people who might disagree given their lack of being able to trust the government. But what's happening is an entity that was not elected by the voter base has now been created by, you know, the mere just thought of someone who's rich enough to be in this position of power, creating a department to go in and, like, remove all of the things that have been in place for decades, to cause more turmoil, to show that there's a way to run a government without having all of these additional people. They're trying to show this effort again, just sort of sticking to the promises that they made during the campaign that people initially voted for. What I think with the Department of Education is interesting because many will argue that the Department of Education has failed students. And then there's a lot of instances and record of that specifically with Black students. And I see that in a lot of my work, and I continue to do research around that. So I think it's going to be an interesting conversation, except this department, this administration is not really willing to have that discussion. It's more of just like what this action is enforcing and showing that force. It's not about progress. It's more about getting rid of anything that was in place before to show that they're in this position of power and they have the ability to do so. I recognize it still has to go through Congress and they might even be able to get away with that. But I think what it will be able to do for us as a people is at least have like a real dialogue about the efforts of the Department of Education and how they have been helpful and how they have been harmful.
There is also an attack on DEI, and I'm talking specifically the attack on DEI in historically black universities that is going on right now. Can you speak and compare the situation with historically black universities and Trump's attack on DEI, but compare it with Lowell School in San Francisco? And also, can you give us an historical analysis of how you were ousted from the San Francisco Board of Education and the racism surrounding that?
So what you could think of it as is the case of Lowell High School in San Francisco is sort of a local example of getting rid of DEI. And I say that because not that there was this initiative with those exact words and we were making these efforts, but because to go after merit-based admissions and essentially complain, saying that we're dumbing down the process because we're getting rid of these barriers, these real barriers that were preventing black and brown students from attending that school, by getting rid of that, we'd be dumbing down the school. That alone is saying a lot about their ideas of a certain population, a certain community of students. And it's sort of going after a DEI initiative here in San Francisco without all of those words. So I see it's a very clear comparison of like not being okay with adding these additional ways to get students who haven't had access to attend a school that is very resourceful, giving them the ability to do that. Students who have historically been unable to attend for decades created this outcry from alumni, from current parents whose students attend the school, from sometimes even teachers and community members like our former mayor even, to say that it was something that is going to ruin San Francisco public schools. And I just see it as an effort of keeping it segregated. And I would say that consistently, but because it was one of the biggest battles that has happened long before I was even on the board, it became something that enraged enough people to come after us.
And what do you feel that they were really attacking you for?
I kind of would say this consistently, but it was the fact that I would call people out for having racist beliefs or racist ways of operating was very hard for them to listen to or even have a discussion around. So then it became how when someone is calling you a racist, it's almost like they don't even listen anymore. They can't engage in a conversation because they're so offended about this idea that they're not seeing some of the practices they're utilizing. Some of these behaviors have racist undertones. So I think that discomfort is really what enraged a lot of people as well, just having to constantly be told that that's what, if they're siding with this, there's essentially this understanding that you're siding with segregation. You're siding with keeping black and brown students from having access to a school that is elevating a lot of the student body there to make it further in their educational career. It was a clear separation. And by being against this shift, it's essentially siding with all of that.
Last question. Can you talk about how an Asian woman is being used by the right wing to basically crush black and brown students excelling in San Francisco schools? And name names, please.
I'm assuming, or I would say perhaps this is more on a former board member who was appointed, Anne Hsu, not elected to the Board of Education. She was appointed after we were recalled, and would be the one who was the loudest specifically about these efforts. And a lot of examples came up specifically when she would say, as an example, calling some students the riffraff, essentially equating them to trash or garbage. It was usually pointed at specific students
usually black or brown, that she would say weren't paying attention, their families didn't care. And this was all documented in different ways throughout her campaign or whenever she was at the dais on the board. It's all recorded. But she became the head of this movement in a way when the recall started. And she showed that for families who are Chinese American, you know, whose families have come to this country and wanted to make sure that their students are also advancing, convinced that there's this idea that it's us against them. And so when some of this rhetoric started coming out and this idea that because we were switching the admissions role at Lowell, we were now taking away the opportunity for Chinese students, for example, to attend, then it was sort of like, well, of course, someone's going to want to push back against that. You know, it would come up consistently. There was another case with a different principal who was also Asian American and would repeatedly use the N-word. It was a meeting that she held with the student body to reference how harmful this word was, but kept repeating it. And the families told her the reason why this isn't okay. And it was one of those instances where they can get away with a lot of these things that are creating harm for students. And then when we talk about how it's creating harm, there's this instance that, well, now we're racist because we're calling them out. And it just is, it's really hard to have discussions and clear conversations with people when they don't hear, when they can't listen after they've been told that they're hurting people.
Last question. What do you think about the banning of books that have been going on in the United States? How will it affect students, particularly black and brown students?
Well, number one, I think it's truly unfounded. Anyone who is making a choice to remove any entity, any piece of writing based off of like specific keywords or a certain plot in a writing or in a story is ignorant in many ways, because it now doesn't even have anything to do with the message or what they believe people are learning based off of these books. It's just sort of this idea that if these words are in the book or if these topics are discussed, they shouldn't be given to students. All of that is driven by this idea that there's a woke agenda, which was a word that they've completely co-opted and now have turned on its head. There's this woke agenda that's turning all of our students into hating white students or white people, for example. And when you're navigating huge decisions this way on like a baseless foundation, then again, you're not really for making progress or protecting students. You're really just about enforcing your agenda and saying that it's to make sure that the other people's agenda, the woke agenda, is not continuing. And as an educator, as someone who like knows the importance of reading and writing and knows the history of black students, for example, not having access to reading or the ability to read and how that's rooted in slavery, I mean, all of that is connected in ways that shows up when you have discussions of banning books, of getting rid of literature.
You are just listening to the voice of Gabriela Lopez, former member of the Board of Education in San Francisco. I want to just thank you for being with us and informing us and giving us your input on this very important debate that's going on in the nation right now.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Peace.
Bye.
That was former San Francisco Board of Education President Gabriela Lopez speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. Since the recording of this interview, the San Francisco School District began considering cutting 800 jobs. You can find more from JR at blockreportradioworld.com.
Sue me.
Michael Jackson, They Don't Care About Us. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Activists protested the National Basketball Association's relationship with Rwanda outside the NBA All-Star Game at San Francisco's Chase Center on Sunday, February 16th. The NBA has a long-standing relationship with Rwanda, despite decades of UN documentation of its human rights crimes in Rwanda and the neighboring Democratic Republic of the Congo, where Rwandan troops and Rwandan-commanded M23 militia are now occupying the capitals of Congo's north and south Kivu provinces. In 2021, the NBA chose to inaugurate its affiliated Basketball Africa League in Kigali, Rwanda's capital. In a 2024 exposé titled How the NBA Got into Business with an African Dictator, sports media outlet ESPN accused the NBA of, quote, sports washing, end quote, Rwanda's reputation. Activists and even two U.S. senators have called on the NBA to cut its ties with Rwanda, but an NBA spokesperson told ESPN that the U.S. government had encouraged them to do business with Rwanda and that they would continue to follow its guidance. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports.
Stanford graduate student and activist Fatou Berry explained why she helped organize the protest.
We went to the Chase Center to raise awareness about Rwanda's ongoing occupation of the Congo. We were calling on the NBA to cut all ties with Rwanda in support of Congolese government issuing a statement for the NBA to withdraw its support from Rwanda.
Berry said that many people outside the Chase Center stopped to talk to them and responded to their message that Black Lives Matter in the Congo as well as at home.
The NBA has a history of social justice. They supported the activist movement against police brutality. So we were calling on them to recognize the contradiction in turning a blind eye away from the ongoing genocide in the Congo. We wanted them to acknowledge that Black Lives Matter here and abroad.
Berry also said that she and fellow activists are appealing to the U.S. government to stop encouraging the NBA to do business with Rwanda.
A destabilized Congo is not in the best interests of the U.S. government. Destabilizing the Congo has caused displacement of 7 million people. And just in the past months since M23, Rwanda-backed militia groups have stormed into Goma and have recently taken Bukavu, 500,000 people plus in the Congo have been displaced. So this crisis warrants the United States government adhere to international law and advocate for the Congo to have control over territory and sovereignty over its country.
She also thanked Chance the Rapper for giving a shout out to Palestine, Sudan, and Congo from inside the Chase Center.
Yeah, it was amazing to see his support on such a national platform. And I think this goes to show that a lot of the NBA fans and supporters and activists still love the game because of this precedent that they have. So it's important that they continue with this ideology that Black Lives Matter here and abroad.
That was Stanford graduate student and activist Fatoumata Berry speaking with Pacifica's Ann Garrison. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from J.R. Valray, Steve Zeltzer, and Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.